Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. By some estimates, China will likely surpass the United States to become the leading economic superpower by 2016. At the same time, China's second quarter gross domestic product data showed few positive data points, and economists have cut their forecast for 2013 and 2014 growth. July 19th, Paul Krugman wrote, quote, "China is in big trouble. We're not talking about some minor setback along the way, but something more fundamental. The country's whole way of doing business, the economic system that has driven three decades of incredible growth, has reached its limits. You could say the Chinese model is about to hit its great wall, and the only question now is just how bad the crash will be." Today's guests, Orville Schell and John DeLory, have both devoted a lot of time to studying and writing about China, including co-authoring the new book, Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. We'll explore what seems to be China's current story on a number of fronts. The world's most populous country boasts a rapidly expanding military, growing influence in global affairs. And Schell and DeLory both say that China's pursuit of national greatness comes after generations of foreign occupation and civil war has come to define the Chinese character, and that this determined quest for wealth and power remains key to understanding many of China's actions today. By examining the lives of 11 influential officials, writers, activists, and leaders whose contributions helped create modern China, Wealth and Power creates a modern portrait of China's progress from its peak of prosperity and flourishing around 1800 through its century of humiliation under pressure from Western and Japanese imperialism until its reemergence in 1949. James Fallows, who spent a lot of time in China, writes, "I'd suggest you read it. If you're at all interested in China, it's both historical and current, and it does a better job than most other books of answering a basic question the rest of the world naturally asks about China's recent rise. What does China want?" And then he, in parentheses, he says, "granting the preposterousness of this question as applied to a diverse group of a billion-plus people." Then he asks, "what is all the building and bustle and sacrifice and preening for?" He says, "you may not be certain of the answer to that question by the time you finish this book, but you'll be in a very good position to discuss it." Here on Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to know how. Let me give you biographies on both of my guests. Orville Schell studied Chinese history at Harvard and Berkeley and has written for The Atlantic, The New Yorker, Time, Foreign Affairs, The New York Review of Books, Harper's, and The New York Times. Formerly the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California in Berkeley, he is currently the Arthur Ross Director of the Asia Society Center on U.S.-China Relations in New York City. He's author of 15 books, including Virtual Tibet, The Reform Years, Mandate of Heaven, The Legacy of Tiananmen Square, and The Next Generation of Chinese Leaders, and his latest with John DeLory, as I said, Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. John DeLory received his PhD in Modern Chinese History at Yale, taught at Brown, Columbia, and Peking University, and was Associate Director of Asia Society's Center on U.S.-China Relations. He's currently a Senior Fellow of the Center on U.S.-China Relations and an Assistant Professor of East Asian Studies at Yonsei University in South Korea. His writings have recently appeared in Foreign Policy, Slate, and World Policy Journal. Welcome to Freeform, Orville Schell and John DeLory.
Pleasure. Thanks for having us.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So I've mentioned just a few highlights, but can you each briefly bring to life your path to the work that you do today? Feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision. John, why don't you go first?
Okay, well, my story is a little shorter in terms of China than Orville's, but, you know, I sort of picked up with an interest in China in high school, actually. I grew up outside of Sacramento, California, and, you know, stumbled into some books of ancient Chinese philosophy, starting with the Taoists, and then I got into the Confucians. And then I had a chance to travel to China. I spent a summer there about 20 years ago. So for me, there was some combination of something resonated in these very old philosophical texts, plus being sort of dropped off, parachuting down the middle of Beijing at a time when there are very few foreigners there, especially not a lot of American teenagers, not speaking the language, really not understanding what was going on. But that gave me the bug to want very intensely to master the language and to sort of figure out the country. So that sort of set me off on the path that I'm on now, and I've focused my energy through the discipline of history to try and use China's past as the gateway to understanding, you know, where it is now and where it's heading.
Okay. And just so people get a fuller feel of you, John, outside of China, what's driven you? What's you know, what are the big questions you pursue? How you describe your path?
Well, you know, I don't know. There's not a lot outside of China. I live in Korea, so I have sort of expanded my interests. I've married into the Korean tribe, and we have two beautiful half Irish American, half Korean children. So I've sort of broadened my horizons onto the Korean Peninsula. I've been going to North Korea for the last few years and thinking a lot about that as well. But I would say I'm pretty deeply immersed in East Asia, in the questions really that I started to think about as a high school kid.
Very good. Oliver Schell.
I sort of stumbled into China as a student at college, and ultimately I think the fact that you couldn't go there was an alluring sort of proposition. It sort of begged you to keep trying to see if there's in some way to sort of breach that wall. I ended up going to Taiwan to study Chinese and spent a lot of time in Southeast Asia and Indonesia, and then finally did go to China in 1975, which really was before China started to change. In fact, the Cultural Revolution was still going on. And I think even once I got there, there was this kind of very impermeable membrane between us and them. And I probably, having a penchant for lost causes, this did sort of, I think, have a strange allure because it raised so many questions and made me so curious about what actually was this place all about and how could I better plummet and understand it. So ever since then, I've been seeking to do that.
Before delving into a number of specific areas I want to cover during the course of the interview, let me ask you the question Fallows mentions in his comment. What does China want? What is all the building and bustle and sacrifice and preening for? John.
Well, you know, as he says, how do you summarize 1.37 billion people? But what we try to do in our book is to break it down to 11 people. So we structured the book around this group of figures who we think can help tell the story of what China has wanted in its modern history. And so the short answer to that question is the title of our book, Wealth and Power. This is a phrase, Fuqiang, in Chinese, that, like many Chinese phrases, was coined 2,500 years ago, but resurfaces in the 19th century quite dramatically. And this becomes a kind of, it's almost a quiet rallying cry for generation after generation of reformist intellectuals and thinkers, as well as political leaders. And what's so striking to us and what we sort of map out in the book is how across this broad spectrum of people who wanted to change China, Chinese who wanted to change China, the one point they agreed on was that their goal was to restore the nation to strength and prosperity. So, you know, that's at least part of the answer to the question that Fallows poses, is indeed the title of our book, What China Has Wanted is Wealth and Power. Now, as they seem to achieve it, it sets up a whole new set of questions is, wait a second, once they have wealth and power, and once they're rich, how do they want to spend their money? Once they're powerful, how do they want to exert their power? Do they have principles that they stand for? So this is where a book in answering one question opens up a whole set of other questions.
Right. And I must say that my biggest sort of thing at the end of it was exactly what you say, is that if you've motivated yourself through such enormous different changes since 1849 by this sense of humiliation, the sense of shame, that when that is no longer the reality, What does it mean in terms of motivation? And what does it mean in terms of culture? What does it mean in terms of change? And we'll talk more about that. Orville, anything you want to add?
I think, you know, one of the things that drove us to do this was that even though we've spent a lot of our lives reading Chinese history and trying to parse through it and understand it, it didn't really make a whole lot of sense to us. The narrative kept changing. And the end point, you know, at different points in the last 150 years, was so completely different from previous end points. And I think this, what became evident to us was that, you know, unlike our own country, which is rather constant, even though we have ups and downs, or Britain, or even France that had, you know, one sort of cultural political system, a revolution, and then stumbled around and then put together another. China was had this sort of endless succession of sort of self-reinventions, efforts to try things on, all dedicated to trying to find some way to reinstate the country as being a place in the world that could be, of which people could be proud and that was of consequence. So there was this very profound utilitarian kind of streak in Chinese reforms and revolutions that was always looking for the new answer. And in many ways, of course, this was incredibly negating of what it was that China had been and had been with a vengeance for several millennia. So this kind of strange, disconnected quality of Chinese history was a kind of a beckon to us to say, all right, well, how then does it add up? How do you make sense out of this? And even more important, how did they get to this new ending, which is an ending, hasn't ended forever, but so far it's an ending with much more success than any of the other endpoints throughout the last 150 years.
Mm-hmm. That's the voice of Orville Schell, and the other voice of my guest today is John DeLory. We're talking about China. I wanted to say one thing that struck me as curious. When you mentioned how you can't talk about a country of over a billion people very easily, and so you focused on 11 leaders, I realized I think I haven't done that many shows on China. The last one that I remember was John Pomfret in his book Chinese Lessons, in which he looked at the last 20 years or so by looking at individuals again. So maybe it's what one does when faced with that kind of a challenge.
Yeah, well, this is John. It is a way, you know, we've had this discussion, been asked, is this kind of a philosophy of history behind the book, you know, the kind of classic great man in history, and or in our case, you know, 10 great men and one great woman. So there's a chapter on the Empress Dowager Cixi. But I don't think that's really what's driving it. I mean, we're not trying to make claims that the sort of intellectual history and political history that we do is sort of the right way to do history. By any means, that's not the purpose. But we do think that these individuals, especially the political figures, have had a profound shaping influence. I mean, when you talk about people like Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping, you certainly can't tell the story of 20th century China without getting into them. But for us, it is maybe more of a literary conceit mm-hmm. rather than a claim about history. You know, it's a way to help people, especially for whom Chinese history is forbidding, you know, and very much foreign territory, and it's hard to hang on to even one single Chinese name. We try to pick a group who we really can draw out their flesh and blood and their individuality, but then explore their ideas and their actions to help, you know, tell this story. So I think in great measure it's as much a literary device as it is a historiographical one.
Yeah, that makes very good sense to me, and I'm sure that's the same thing that went on with Pomfret on his book as well. You've alluded to it. Let me just set this up. China has an ancient culture, at least 4,000 years old, compared to the U.S. of 300 to 400 years. So my first question is, what is the impact of that ancient culture in the 21st century? And let me just back it up by saying, in America, we see politicians constantly referencing the founding fathers and some of them Judeo-Christian thought. But in China, it seems to me they reference philosophy and older philosophy much more than we do.
Well, you know, I think in our country, our sort of basic traditional political culture was our founding fathers, who were very much children of the Enlightenment in Europe. And so in a certain sense, our culture and political culture has, we are still in our traditional form. We're constantly seeking to try to return to it in a truer way. China, on the other hand, had these many millennia of Confucian culture and also sort of sidecars of Taoism, legalism, Buddhism. But its modern experience was in revolt against those. And that's really what the story of Mao Zedong is all about. I mean, Mao Zedong was this kind of incredible walking contradiction, this guy who wrote classical poetry, did calligraphy, loved the old novels of the, you know, the knight errants and read the classics. On the other hand, he was massively against it. Spent his whole life raging against this old culture, which he found confining, you know, suffocating and lacking in dynamism. So their experience was one of sort of endless iconoclasm, whereas ours was sort of one of endless affirmation. This is extremely difficult, and for China, it was very, very hard because they had to overthrow something which was deeply organically rooted in them, and then they had to kind of come up with something else. And they had did this one time after another with new versions of the something else, and they're still at it, and they still don't quite know what the final something else is going to be. So this creates a fundamental instability at the very heart of this extremely dynamic proposition of the Chinese sort of economic revolution. And this, I think, you could say is one of the major sort of contradictions of sociology in China.
Well, one of the things you point out is that all of these figures, I think, that you know, that you turn to in the book, all are part of that. How do we break out of our thousands of years of tradition? And yet you say that a number of them, in their elder years, return to it.
Yeah, that's another, in a way, surprising pattern of the book, is that, you know, this cultural hold was so strong, even on the figures who are consciously engaged in a project of self-negation. You know, they identify by the turn of the 20th century, many of the leading figures, you know, that we devote our chapters to, they've identified traditional culture, traditional values, Confucianism. They start to call it feudalism and feudal values and the feudal spirit. They identify these things as the core of the problem, the reason that they're backward and poor, and they're trying consciously to destroy it. They're calling on their countrymen to break through these bonds and to literally change Chinese consciousness. And yet, in their own elder years, twilight years, we find these figures returning to these ancient Confucian texts that Orville was talking about and finding a kind of comfort in them. And it's quite fascinating, you know, as your question alluded to, for us to watch, even in the last decade, a sort of revival of this old Confucian language. And let me give you, you know, two prominent examples of it. One is around 10 years ago with the new leader, Hu Jintao. He started talking about this notion of harmony, you know, and harmony became the kind of buzzword, and that was what you know, if you were a local official who wanted to get extra money in the budget, you said, well, this is for harmonious society, you know, this is part of harmony. And that was shocking in many ways to people like us who study Chinese political language, because it's not just the total antithesis of Mao, who talked about struggle and class struggle and cultural struggle, but it's also alluding to this old Confucian language, and they were quoting Confucian texts.
Interesting.
And so when you got to the Beijing Summer Olympics, if you remember that incredible extravaganza of the opening ceremony, it all centered on this one Chinese character of He, of harmony.
Oh, yeah.
So it was this incredible return of, again, a 2,500-year-old concept. But after this period in which those organic cultural links have been broken. So as Orville suggests, it's quite different. On the one hand, there is a sort of analogy to the way in which Americans would cite founding fathers, but it's quite different. You would have to imagine that the United States went through a period in which they utterly rejected the Constitution, and trashed the basic principles of equality and liberty and all these things, and then somehow later, strangely, started to come back to it. You know, so that's what we're seeing in Chinese political language now. It's quite surprising.
Well, as far-fetched as to say that is, one could say that describes the South, who on the one hand did trash the Constitution in the Civil War and probably are the most traditional where the most traditional thinking about the Constitution now emerges. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally, and the voice you just heard was John DeLory. The other voice today is Orville Schell. They are authors together of Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. You can learn more at Orville Schell, O-R-V-I-L-L-E-S-C-H-E-L-L, OrvilleSchell.com, and more about the book at ChinaWealthPower.com. I want to read just a couple of things about Mao since you brought him up, Orville, and let's focus on him as someone who exemplified in, as you point out, in some sense, the most successful attack on the humiliation and the shame. And you suggest much of Mao's destructive legacy should be viewed less through the prism of radical Marxism than as an attempt to exorcise Confucian passivity. And you quote Mao, founding the People's Republic in 1949, "The Chinese have always been a great, courageous, and industrious nation. It is only in modern times that they have fallen behind. Ours will no longer be a nation subject to insult and humiliation," 1949. You quote scholar John Fairbank, "In the old society, teachers were venerated by students, women were submissive to their husbands, and age was deferred to by youth. Breaking down such a system took a long time because one had to change one's basic values and assumptions accepted in childhood. The times called for a leader of violent willpower, a man so determined to smash the old bureaucratic establishment that he would stop at nothing." Speak a bit more about Mao's sort of paradoxical role, the most destructive, and yet once that era is over, once we come out of that, he's in fact finally shifted us perhaps into the future and set up this, you know, as you say, instead of preparing China for the version of utopian socialism, he instead paved the way for China's transformation into exactly the kind of capitalist economy he most reviled during his lifetime. I'm quoting you again, but also a nation that Mao, like every modern Chinese reformer before him, dreamed of fashioning a strong and prosperous one.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, Mao, there's an enormous paradox in Mao, his sort of savage, brutal revolution, which was consecrated towards sort of pushing China into a Marxist utopian conclusion, ends up with the counter-revolution of Deng Xiaoping and sort of a marketization of the country and sort of Leninist capitalism. And I think, you know, you have to really understand Mao and, you know, what he may have kind of inadvertently accomplished. You have to look at, I mean, one predecessor that we write about, who most listeners probably haven't heard of, but Chen Duxiu was a man who founded the Communist Party. But originally, he had studied the imperial to pass the imperial exams and become an imperial official. Then he rejected that. And then he rejected tradition, his whole sort of education, all of his classical learning, and he became a very ardent democrat, a believer in democracy and science. Well, that didn't work out too well. So then he became a communist, and he helped found the Communist Party in 1921, and then he got purged. That didn't work out so well. So then he sort of ended up being an enemy even of the nationalists and imprisoned. And in the very end of his life, a kind of a terribly tragic life for this brilliant writer, editor, political activist, he drifted off to the mountains and started studying ancient Chinese philology. And then he passed away. So you see, this was the trajectory of all of these people trying this, trying that, rejecting their past and sort of coming to nothing. And I think in a certain sense, Mao Zedong was psychologically indisposed to moderation of any kind, had a terrible struggle with his father as a young boy. So he just went for broke, and he tipped the country upside down, backwards and forwards, and it was brutal. But like great sort of historical, you know, leaders who actually end up having an impact for better or worse. He did, I think, finally turn that sort of super tanker of Chinese culture around and allowed China in some very elemental way then to break loose under Deng Xiaoping into this period of economic dynamism that we now are watching unfold.
He also, this is John, if I can add, I mean, another effect of Mao and the radicalism of the Maoist period in the last decades of the 50s and 60s, leading up to Mao's death in 1976, is, you know, he created a populace that was so weary of politics and ideology and was therefore so ready for the message of Deng Xiaoping, which was pragmatism. I mean, a kind of almost making a religion out of pragmatism, of whatever works, that's what we'll do. And so, you know, that's another way in which Mao sort of cleared the ground for Deng, is that Deng was able to, you know, swoop in and say, literally, I mean, the Communist Party under Deng's leadership made a pronouncement in 1978 and said, we are officially shifting from class struggle to economic development. I mean, it was that crystal clear in their language of what they wanted to do. And Deng could enjoy a huge amount of popular support for that because people were so sick of the Maoist period, you know. And, I mean, this can have strange ripple effects, something like the question of democracy, which I'm sure we're going to get to. In Mao's period and during the Cultural Revolution, one of the most devastating periods under Mao, everything was described as democracy. This was described as mass democracy.
Uh-huh.
You know, Mao said, I'm unleashing true people's democracy. They called it democratic dictatorship. They called it all these other things, but they called it democratic. And so in that sense, Chinese of a certain generation had very negative associations with democracy. And when Deng came along and basically said, I'm not giving you democratic reform, but I'm also not forcing you into any more mass democratic campaigning. Let's just forget about politics, and you trust the party for politics, but we're going to let you make money now. The people were ready for that. And that's still the kind of social contract that China has, and it has at least lasted with certainly some big ups and downs, but has lasted until today.
Very good. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Orville Schell and John DeLory. The last voice was John's. They're authors together of Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. You can learn more at orvilleschell.com, and Schell is S-C-H-E-L-L. And for the book, ChinaWealthPower.com. As I said, this is Free Forum. We're on TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally, TerrenceMcNally.net, or AWorldThatJustMightWork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and what we're going to talk about and three or four articles of background, you can sign up at my site or by emailing me at TEMcNally, TEMcNally, at Mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to Free Forum podcast on iTunes. You can also check out Free Forum with Terrence McNally on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. John, you also have a Twitter account?
I believe I do. Just John DeLury. Very
okay.
Simple. To
and that's D-E-L-U-R-Y.
Correct.
Okay. We're going to go into more specifics, democracy, economy, et cetera. But I wanted to just, as we leave sort of the big notion of your book as the focus, I wanted to mention a couple of things. Unlike the U.S. celebrating the 4th of July or France Bastille Day, the inaugural exhibition at the National Museum of China in Tiananmen Square, splashily reopening in 2011, was called The Road to Rejuvenation, and it treated the Opium War as the founding event of modern China. In your research, you found that this idea of national rejuvenation is the current and modern Chinese intellectual thought we've been talking about. Now, President Xi Jinping recently added a new dimension by introducing the notion of a China dream. What does he mean by that? Your thoughts about that. Is that going to be a shift?
Well, this is good because I promised earlier, Terrence, in our discussion, two examples of how Confucian language resurfaces.
And harmony was one.
You come back to me with the second one.
All right.
Which is rejuvenation, you know, and this is something that the new president and general secretary of the party, Xi Jinping, as you say, has really stressed and brought forward as kind of, in a way, like harmony was for Hu Jintao, his predecessor. he's talking about rejuvenation. And this, too, is a very old word, you know, that goes back to ancient times, and you see it in different guises, and it's something that many of the figures in our book talk about, that they were hoping for some kind of zhenxing, you know, which is another sort of term for fuxing, the term that Xi Jinping used in the Chinese for restoration. So again, this is we're seeing this phenomenon of old language resurfacing in contemporary times. Now, the China Dream is a little bit different because the China Dream does not sound old. It has no Confucian antecedents. To a classically trained Chinese, it sounds almost a little corny. And I think, you know, Orville will have reflections on this, too, because both of us are asking, you know, on our trips and in our contact with Chinese friends and interlocutors, you know, everyone's asking the same question, what is a China Dream? What does this mean? And at this stage, it seems, one thing that seems clear to me is that there's a sort of strategic ambiguity in the term. Xi Jinping is leaving the definition open-ended so that people can pile in their own meanings. And so the China Dream is kind of what you want it to be. There's some of that going on. At another level, and this is explicit in his statements about the China Dream, at a kind of national level, although the language is new, the meaning is utterly consonant with what we talk about in our book, because the dream that he will say we're now going to achieve is restoration of wealth and power. So you see how this kind of formula all comes together even into one sentence of the language that the Chinese leadership is using, that they are basically finally realizing this teleology, you know, this goal that has been driving China through its modern history through the last 20 through the last two centuries. They're finally realizing the restoration of national wealth and power for the whole country, and that's the China Dream. So in the China Dream, you put a heavy emphasis on the China part. It's different than the American Dream that Orville might want to talk about. It. There is something much less individualistic, more national, to realizing something for the collective unit, not so much for the individual.
I think that's. I mean, we love our American dream, but it is very much an individual dream of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. The promise that every immigrant, every American has that opportunity to individually and personally realize a better life. And China has certainly provided that for a lot of people, and one must note that and acclaim it. But I think what Xi Jinping, the president, really was referring to was the dream of the greatness of China as a collective entity. And this is something that goes back through every single leader from Mao to Chiang Kai-shek to the Empress Dowager to Liang Qichao, reformer at the turn of the last century, is that idea that that was the dream. In fact, it's very interesting. We start our book with this reformer at the turn of the last century, Liang Qichao, who started to write a novel. And his novel was really a dream. He was dreaming. It was a science fiction kind of dream about what China would look like in 60 years, I believe it was. And it was exactly this. It was exactly, in a strange way, what China has become.
No kidding.
But he couldn't imagine it. He could imagine it, but he couldn't imagine China would ever actually attain it.
Mm-hmm. For to him, it was truly science fiction.
It was, and that was the only sort of succor he could take, was to dream it.
Yeah.
Because it was so elusive in reality.
Wow, interesting. Yeah, you guys both went back to it, but as soon as I saw that Chinese dream, I thought, you know, is this, how does this compare, and is this some sort of a resonance with the American dream? I mean, I have not made a study of it, but are there many cultures or nations that claim a dream?
I think the Chinese idea of a Chinese China dream is a little bit derivative, you know, from Martin Luther King and the American dream. But I think it is a way to kind of an effort by the party to sort of motivate people and make them think that the party has an actual purpose, that has some sort of destination in mind for everybody. So it's an important thing.
And as you point out, when you say something like dream, you do leave it open. And so it's basically saying, forgive me, but it seems to me it's saying to the country, imagine your China. Imagine the China we want to be, rather than this working backward from the China we don't want to be.
Exactly. I think there's a hint of, it's a space that wants to be occupied by a certain idealistic projection of everyone.
Very good. Let's turn to, we'll turn to democracy, but first to economics, because that's how I sort of led off the intro with the projection that China will become the economic superpower, the leading economic superpower within a very few years, and then the more near-term projection that they're by Paul Krugman, they're about to hit the China Wall, the Great Wall. What do you both sense? I will read one more quote from Krugman to set it up. The main thing holding down Chinese consumption seems to be that Chinese families never see much of the income being generated by the country's economic growth. Some of that income flows to a politically connected elite, but much of it simply stays bottled up in businesses, many of them state-owned.
Yeah, I mean, this is, we're not economists, as we keep emphasizing, but of course we listen to the best economists, both in China and the best China expert economists outside. It seems pretty clear there's a division right now. Of view, and some people agree with Krugman. My sense is still that the majority of economists who really work full time on China, unlike Paul Krugman,
right, who works full time on Krugman. No, go ahead.
Yeah, no, but I mean, he's a great. You don't want to bet against Krugman.
Right.
I have my students read his stuff that anticipated the Asian financial crisis. But you also have to be careful when you bet against China.
Yeah.
Because, the Chinese economy has defied a number of these predictions really for decades. And so economists have had to not rewrite their textbook, but rethink some of their premises and also rethink their analysis. So what I see right now among economic experts of China is I don't think most people are yet with Krugman in seeing that, the writing is on the wall and the end is near. Another thing that's important to understand is that, and this has been going on for years, the best economists in China have been talking about the need for structural transformation of their economy. And there's been a recognition that that kind of structural change is probably going to come along with a slowdown in GDP growth, because
mm-hmm.
the growth rate is driven by the model they have, which is an export and investment intensive model. There are also many, both in China and outside, economists who say, well, yeah, this is not great, and this is going to have some negative effect even, of course, on the global economy. But really, this is the kind of change that China needs to go through.
This is that rebalancing between consumption and investment, and between export and an internal middle class economy.
That's right. Yeah. And, they dealt pretty skillfully started with the U.S. credit crisis and became global financial crisis, and China hit the accelerator and put out a huge, stimulus package. But then that stimulus package, which was praised by economists for being pretty effective, also contributed to their problem of local debt,
mm-hmm.
which they well know is a big problem. So, I mean, they're like most economies in the world, they are sailing through Scylla and Charybdis here. But my sense is, from reading the people who are crunching their numbers all the time and thinking about it, is that even a Paul Krugman and others may have leapt to conclusions by focusing too much on slowdown in GDP and not looking at the whole complicated mixture of factors that are involved in China's, sustained economic growth. I think they're still relatively early in a very long process of economic development. And when you go there and travel around the country, you see how there's still so much growth potential and the incredible energy that people have, how hard people work as individuals and as families. And so, you know, that dynamism, certainly you're not feeling that when you go to China. You don't see people sitting around saying, well, the good days are over.
They are
blazing forward, whatever Paul Krugman writes
about. Right. Before you chime in, Orville, let me set it up with a couple of more notions and questions here. It seems that because the balance, the current balance, is so weighted to state enterprise and so on, that a shift to a more privatized economy could be a scary thing for the leadership. So Americans and Chinese pushing for a rapid change should maybe be careful what they wish for, since a collapse that like Krugman's talking about isn't good for anyone. Secondly, now that China has a middle class, can leaders still get away with the idea we do everything for the sake of the nation? And could you talk just a little bit about the middle class? How big is it and what does it look like?
Well, I think at this point of our sort of globalized world, whatever you may think about Chinese communism, the party, its authoritarian bent, the way it treats its people, et cetera, you would be very foolish to wish for a collapse of the Chinese economy, much less China itself, because we are all so interconnected that it would have profound implications on Europe and America and every place else. So, like it or not, we are kind of joined at the hip here. And this means we do have to work out our problems one way or another. And China's sort of economic reform is in a certain sense in the interest of the United States as well. Just like their foreign investment now, as it moves out abroad in greater and greater numbers of dollars, is going to influence our economy. So that, I think, is the first point to note. On the other hand, I mean, I have had many occasions over the past 25 years when I thought, well, how does this thing work? Why does it work? How can it continue to work? And then you hit a speed bump someplace and you think, oh, boy, here we go. China's going to buy the farm this time. Well, they haven't. But there are a tremendous number of unattended to contradictions and problems that are building up within the Chinese system, economic and otherwise. And that's really the question, that at some point, I mean, China's kept moving at this amazing rate and changing its direction, shifting course, you know, as the winds change around it. But right now, it's a little unclear whether this new leadership will have that kind of prerogative to act as boldly as people like Mao and Deng were able to act, to kind of catch the next prevailing wind as it moves in. So they're in a very sort of switchy territory. They've pushed forward a lot of problems, and they've been so sensitive about maintaining stability that when you're so worried about stability, sometimes you can't get to the kinds of real reforms that will best assure your future. So it's a weird contradiction of a lot going on, a lot to be esteemed, a lot to be kind of recognized, and massive problems, environmental, structural, rich and poor, you know, you name it. I would not want to be a leader of China having to solve these problems right now.
Right. Let me just read one other thought I had about the middle class, which is that in the U.S., we've seen the middle class vote against its parents' interests because they assume they will move upward. Now, in China, while there is a huge poverty class, there has been mobility. Do we see the same kind of thinking there among middle class, that they're going to be the next ones to jump into the wealthy?
Yeah, I mean, to go back to your general question on this one about the middle class, I mean, it's hard to give a single number, you know, and of course the definition of the middle class itself can be open-ended in other countries as well. You know, I mean, are you middle class based on income or because you say you're middle class? I remember at one point a poll in the United States where 80% of Americans said they were middle class. Well, okay, you know, you could have a model where that doesn't make sense.
Right, you'd have to be in Lake Wobegon, I think, for that.
Yeah, right. So a lot of middle class and really the whole definition of class is about the perception, as you're talking about, both of oneself and of your trajectory and what you expect of your children. You know, I mean, this comes back to the American dream. The American dream, one way of defining it is that my kids will do better than I do, you know, and that there's an equal opportunity for them to achieve. So, you know, you posed, I think, a very thoughtful question. How does the middle class relate to this core concept of our book, of this sort of national project of wealth and power? And my answer would be that it resonates quite strongly among that sort of demographic group, as strongly as it does with others. So that this historical experience and this kind of historical consciousness is something that I perceive just as strongly among urban professionals or students at the top universities who are basically headed into the middle class, and their professors as well, that they share this kind of understanding, this notion that China has been humiliated, that China has been waiting and working hard to restore itself to a position of wealth and power, and we should also add of respect in the eyes of the world, and that this is the kind of national project. So I think when the government, when the Communist Party speaks that language, as Xi Jinping is, of rejuvenation, that we're achieving this rejuvenation, that that's something that works for that huge, you know, hundreds of millions of people who are entering the middle class or think of themselves in the middle class or aspire to middle class status. And so I think that's a very important part of the picture.
Okay. This is a Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Orville Schell and John DeLury, and they are the authors of Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. You can learn more at orvilleschell.com and at chinawealthpower.com. We're going to shift to talking about politics now and internal politics, and I'm going to read again a little bit to set it up. These are your own words, Orville Schell. There's a great paradox. It used to be that Chinese reformers thought that if they could get wealthy and powerful and expel the foreigners, respect would come naturally from the outside world. But now they've gotten wealthy and powerful, they're beginning to find that respect doesn't necessarily follow simple wealth and power. What they're beginning to discover, but still incompletely, is that to win the respect of the world, which is what wealth and power were supposed to gain them, a country must also first treat its own people with respect. Then you also note the social tensions that China experiences. Excessive taxes to forced land grabs, official brutality, rebellions in the countryside, state-owned enterprise layoffs, loss of retirement pensions, all leading to protests and riots, demands for freedom of spiritual beliefs, ethnic minority demands, and growing concerns about the environment. Where do we stand politically? Where are we going?
Well, I think, you know, there was a kind of a sense that China's problems were externally caused by foreigners preying upon China, and this was sort of the anti-imperialist platform of the whole international communist Marxist-Leninist movement. So they set about to sort of remedy that, and they did that by lofting this sort of wealth and power mantra. And now they've actually become wealthy and powerful, and they find what, you know, why aren't we loved? And why aren't we respected and admired? And so you see their sort of immense fixation now on soft power because they recognize that they're still not able to get the final thing, which was not quite in the bouquet of asks at the time, and that is respect. And so I think, you know, this is where things are going to get complicated for them because, first of all, it's not an external problem alone of whether you can defend yourself and not be bullied. It's also a question of do you have an appealing, alluring sort of culture and society to which other people would like to come and participate. To wit, the United States, for all its problems, is an incredible lodestone for immigrants. China is not. Although in some ways, amongst young people, they enjoy being there a while. I certainly have to acknowledge that.
Yeah, I know young people. They go there. There's the dynamism, I think, that really is attractive. Yeah,
I have two young sons who go over there. They love it. So this is the dilemma now. And that's why I think both John and I feel there is another act that will have to be acted out. And it may be more political and cultural than economic if China really wants to sort of win the kind of acclaim, which I think deep down inside they've yearned for, lo, these century, a century and a half.
And I think one lesson we've learned, I think, in the course of writing this book is rethinking our own views about this question that, of course, Americans in particular are so interested in, and democracy in China, and will it ever happen, why hasn't it happened? I mean, I think one insight I've gotten is to see, when you see the pragmatism of all of these reforms, I mean, your motto for this show is, what is it?
A world that just might work.
A world that just might work. So that's what a lot of the energy of modern Chinese history has gone into, is something that just might work. And, you know, it's sort of interesting to combine that pragmatism and this nationalism about restoring China to a certain position of respect in the world to the question of democracy. Because in the West, democracy has originated out of this notion of innate rights, you know, and liberties. And it's been sort of the resistance of the individual to non-democratic states through revolution-formed liberal democratic systems. Whereas in China, should China follow a path of greater democratization, it's most likely to come because it just might work, because it's pragmatic to do so, and because it's good for the nation to do so. So that's, you know, they may end up arriving at something similar to what is now the predominant political system in advanced economies, but by a slightly different route and with a different kind of rationale for why to do it.
And again, if I'm hearing you correctly, that goes back to what we talked about earlier in the show, which is this 4,000-year-old culture. We go back to the Enlightenment, and thus individual rights, private property, those sort of things are the seeds of democracy. To find the seeds of democracy in their culture is a different set of seeds.
Yeah, I mean, it's very tough to go through the bad earth there of ancient Confucianism and find real democracy. But what you do find are a lot of political values about good governance, about mm-hmm. running the economy and the welfare of the people, and the notion of a benevolent ruler. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's plenty of grounds, not for democracy, but for the notion of good government, you know, and that's something that Chinese reformers have drawn on in this modern period.
Finally, let me ask one. I think I only have time for one last question. We've got about a minute and a half to answer it. Either one of you take it. It's not one of these big summation questions, but it's one thing I want to touch on, which is rule of law, corruption, private property, intellectual property rights. The thing to me that always seems to place – I mean, we've been talking about democracy and a change politically in one sense. What about this one?
Well, this is official mantra of the party, is that they want more rule of law. And in many ways, they're seeking it and implementing it. And, you know, when I first went to China in 1975, there weren't even any courts. So it's much, much better. However, the party still trumps law. And this is one area, I think, that where reforms are urgently needed. And if you speak about soft power being respected, much less being loved, you really do have to afford your people, I think, in this modern world in which we live, the right to seek redress of grievances in some organized, systematic way. And this is something that so far eluded China in large measure. And I don't think China is going to feel it has arrived. The end game of this great, epic century-and-a-half quest until they have a stronger sense of their own justice towards their own people.
Okay. Again, the book is Wealth and Power, and the websites are Orville Schell, orvillescheell.com, and ChinaWealthPower.com for the book. Thank you to Orville Schell and John DeLore. Keep up the good work. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do both of those things at iTunes or at my site. For podcast articles and transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, including looking at my work with story and narrative in organizations, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net. Or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues, and usually three or four articles of background, you can sign up at my site or by emailing me at T.E. McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi and Mark Maxwell in production, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week.